Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Well, nice to see you all here, and welcome to this very special Word in Your Ear. And we're delighted to be dealing with a legendary figure, a great Londoner, a great fashion icon, Dylan Jones.
I thought that was going to go on for quite a while.
Yes. I could see that a mile off.
I know you could. I realised I got a very bad start on that, but I'm not going to ask for a rerun. But it's lovely to have Dylan here again. Dylan, who's been on the podcast in the past.
It's my third time.
There you go. Talking about your book about Live Aid a couple of years ago. And I can't remember what the last time we were talking about.
I think I was just making up numbers.
Okay, you are making up numbers. But this time you're definitely not making up numbers, because Dylan's recently published this monumental work, David Bowie, A Life, which we're going to talk about this evening. So, Dylan, for those who haven't seen it or haven't read it so far, and the opportunity is obviously to buy a copy later on and get it signed by Dylan, what's the basic shape of the book?
The shape of the book is it's an oral biography. There are 180 voices in it all together, 150 of which are new. The other 30 are people who were either dead or it was impossible to get hold of. It's an oral biography, and I mean, there are lots of Bowie books, and some of them are very good. Some of them are awful, but some of them are very, very good. But they're all about the career, which I think if you're a Bowie aficionado, you know about the career. And I wanted to write a book generally about him, about the man, and about people who had genuine relationships with him. So it's a very objective book. I have linking passages, and I sort of, you know, I put myself into the book occasionally, but you're trying to build up a picture, a genuine picture of someone. I think if you speak to 150 people, that starts to develop.
Sure. And how do you start doing that? Presumably you have to get a core of people who will make the book credible. If you have, there's certain people you absolutely have to include, and then there's wider circles beyond that. Would that be right?
I figured that there are the 50 people you need to speak to in order to be taken seriously as a Bowie biographer. Then there are the 50 people who have as much right to talk about their relationship with David Bowie who perhaps don't get asked as often, like photographers, film directors, film producers, hairdressers, makeup artists, lovers, etc., etc. And then there are the other 50 people, when you're interviewing someone, and they say, well, have you spoken to Kevin? You go, well, who the hell's Kevin? So you endeavour to find and interview Kevin. So there are lots of Kevins in this book.
Who's the person you're most pleased with having got hold of?
Well, two of the most interesting people aren't actually in the book. There's a woman called Claire Shenston, who had a very long relationship with Bowie for quite some time, who is responsible for Heroes, because it's her dream about the dolphins that is basically the text of the song. She's quite frail now and quite ill, but I interviewed her at length, and I sent her what I'd written. And in the end, she decided that her relationship was too important for her to be joined in with a chorus of other voices, which is fine. I completely respected that. And the other person was Tony DeFries, which maybe we can talk about.
Right.
But what was it about Bowie? This is a labour of love. I mean, it's a brick-like, fantastic 500-page book.
And it must be very readable.
But very, very readable. Absolutely.
I'm
brick-like.
Just, I'm
it's
very readable.
Absolutely.
Very
fantastic.
Readable.
Yeah. But what was it about Bowie that, for you personally, made you want to undertake that task?
I mean, it's a generational thing, because I was one of those highly susceptible teenagers who saw Top of the Pops in 1972, and he's my generation. He's our generation's Bob Dylan, and I think I think you have to look at the... Remember all those newspaper covers the day after he died? Apart from, I think, the Mail, obviously. You know, they all use Brian Duffy's lightning bolt, and the custodians of the media at the moment are people who grew up with David Bowie. Yeah. And actually, I don't think it's going to... You know, you're going to have Bob Dylan, you're going to have Mick Jagger, and then Paul McCartney. And after that... I don't think there's anyone else. I mean, I do very much subscribe to your school of thought, which is the narrative arc of rock music is reaching its end. And that sort of... Bowie, for me, is probably the most important person in the sort of second half of that period.
Right. So, look, let's talk about some of the people that you've talked to who are featured in this book and played a very important part in David Bowie's life. And this rather blurry old school snap shows... Well, take us through this.
Well, this is George Underwood on the right, but originally for the cover of the book, I mean, you look at Instagram now and the iconography of the lightning bolt, all the Ziggy years, done to death. I mean, amazing, but I wanted a picture of him as a child, just after he's been punched by George Underwood, and you see the eyes, because even as a boy, as a teenager, you can tell it's David Bowie. But the guys at Penguin were a little bit; they just thought this was too much. So I deliberately chose a picture where he doesn't look particularly fashionable. You're not immediately sure where or when it was taken, and he looks like a real person rather than a rock star. So, but the point of this is to explain that I had to approach a lot of these people, including George and Jeff McCormack and his other close friends, about a month after he died. So that first approach is really important, because you don't want to come across as an ambulance chaser. You hope that some of your creds go before you, but you've basically got to say that I'm coming from a good place, that this is coming from a place of love, that this is your testimony. And that's quite difficult. Some people are like, fine, but others you have to do a little bit of coaxing. And I mean, the other thing is you become quite cynical quite quickly. You do 150 interviews, and you'll know this much better than me. But you're sitting down, someone starts to talk, and you go, you're 300 words.
Absolutely. No, you're thinking, I've got to transcribe this.
I mean,
please.
I mean, if you're talking to Julian Temple or Martin Scorsese or someone like that, they can talk that's forever.
Yeah. Was it a Tuesday? Was it a Wednesday? You know, it's not like that doesn't matter.
It's fine, but some people, they're 300 words.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But George, so tell us, an interesting character. I mean, he was they were in a group called George and the Dragons, I think. Was it the King Bees they were in together?
And
what did you learn? I mean, he runs through the whole book and remained a friend of Bowie's right up till the very, very end. So what did you learn about Bowie from George Underwood?
That, he said to George at one point, he said, I mean, there is a history. We talk about Mary Finnegan later, and there's a history of him sort of turning people on and off. But there were a couple of people that he was friends with throughout his entire life. One was Jeff and one was George. And at one point he said to George Underwood, I think this was about 74, 75, he said, I'm going to go off now and I'm going to have this terrific adventure. And we might not see each other for 10 years, but we'll always be friends. And they were. And if I think he had, I mean, you were talking about this earlier, he had the ability to decide he wanted to do things. It's like, let's dance. I want to make a really commercial record. And you go back to the early 70s, and I think he said to himself, you know what, I'm going to become a really good drug addict for a couple of years. I'm going to take a lot of coke.
He made a great success of
and
that.
And I'm going to be the best drug addict there ever is, you know, there ever was. And he was, and he came out of it.
Worked hard at it.
He didn't die.
Yeah. Just, I'm now, because I'm old enough to have forgotten loads of great rock and roll stories, remind me, and for the benefit of the odd benighted soul in the house who may not know what George Underwood did to David Bowie.
I mean, everyone in this room is going to know, but
they may not.
But George Underwood is responsible. They had a fight over a girl. He punched him. consequently, the eyes. You know, one of the three or four most iconic things about Bowie, which meant he was colorblind, and he looked, you know, when he finally arrived in 1972, looked even odder than he would have done with the pan stick and the orange hair and the funny clothes and the codpiece.
So he was colorblind. So what does that tell you about the funny clothes? I mean, was he unable to see the colors that we can see?
Did he know his hair was orange?
Did he have...
Talk about speaking ill of the dead.
He'd be the first one to laugh.
I mean, we've got... Where is the Beau Brummel slide? Have we got that?
I'll whip through. Go on, I'll whip through. We're going to take this out of order. It doesn't matter. Okay.
The Beau Brummel... I mean, you talk about fashion. And the thing is, people think that David Bowie is a fashion icon, that he was a dandy. He wasn't. He just... He understood the power of clothes in terms of costume, but he understood the power of clothes in the way that he understood the power of choreography or great lighting or theatre design, drama. And he became very, very good at it. Once he'd been sort of educated by Angie, he became incredibly good at it. And also he had... You know, one of his greatest traits, I think, being the word I can never properly put, an autodidact.
All right.
You know, he had this huge curiosity, which was based in insecurity because he didn't have a very good education, but constant curiosity of when he's being made up, he's talking to the makeup artist about which clubs do you go to, what do you read, what's the perfume you've got. So he knew about fashion and he cared about fashion, but... whenever you saw him off duty, and I saw him off duty quite a few times, he looked, you know, like he'd come to fix the fridge. It's like he just had a polo shirt on and chinos. But when he decided that he was going to use fashion, he used it better than anyone else.
Right, right, right. So let's just...
There's a sound of disbelief in your voice, David.
I believe you. And I'm particularly interested in the autodidact thing, because has that in common with so many major rock figures who've never finished their education? John Lennon, Paul McCartney, yeah. Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen.
Self-educated.
And they kind of spent the rest of their lives
catching up,
didn't they?
And actually, he was smart enough to use what he learnt in an artistic way to interpret it, and actually often in a quite gauche way, and make real art out of it, because he had an amazing ability to harness his own talents using other people's influences.
Right.
There's a bit where... Beckenham Arts Lab. This is a really fascinating moment, because up until this point, reading the book, you get the impression that he's just a bit behind the beat, which is understandable, because he's a teenager, and mod comes along and he forms a mod band, and R&B comes along and he forms an R&B band, and he doesn't know whether he wants to be Jack Brel or Bob Dylan or James Brown or whatever. And suddenly, he forms this arts lab in the back room of a pub in Beckenham, and at that point seems to be moving into the future, doing things that are way ahead of what's going on.
Well, even then, I think... I mean, you're so right, and it's... Isn't it extraordinary? I mean, he spent 10 years... slightly behind the curve.
Yeah.
With the wrong clothes.
Yeah.
Just slightly off. 10 years where he's relentlessly trying to be successful. And he's a mod, and he's R&B, and he's a folk duo, and he does mime, and he's a children's entertainer. He does all these things.
Simon and Garfunkel.
None of them worked. Yeah. But this was a period... In fact, this didn't... I mean, this was...
But it was the time of Space Oddity, wasn't it?
Yeah, which was a novelty hit. And it was for 3 years afterwards, he was a one-hit wonder. But I think Mary Finnegan might be in this picture.
I think it's that she may be the top right there.
But that's... I mean, Mary Finnegan was fascinating. She was a lovely person to talk to. She was his lover and then landlady. In fact, no, landlady and then lover, I think, became a lover because she was his landlady.
He was fantastically good at meeting girls and getting them to look after him, wasn't he?
Oh, yes.
It's astonishing.
The best kind of rock star.
Yeah, absolutely.
But her story if I heard one person, I mean, she said it, but then this was replicated 30, maybe more times throughout the book, the people I spoke to. He had this amazing ability to turn people off. So he was had a relationship with Mary Finnegan. They created the Beckenham Arts Centre together, this back room in a pub. They did the free festival. They were quite close for a certain amount of time, 18 months or something. And then he goes off and he's really famous. And then he invites her to the Earl's Court Ziggy Stardust gig. Spring of 1973, I think. Is that right? I think it is. And she goes to the gig. Very, very nice concert. There's a party afterwards. She goes to the party. And then the party's winding down. And she describes Bowie going up to her, taking her by the hand, leading her to the door, opening the door, giving her a kiss and saying, "Mary Finnegan, it's been fantastic knowing you," and closing the door. And literally and metaphorically, just that's the end of their relationship. And that, I mean, it sort of happened, and I'm, you know, and we all know Rockstar for a little bit, and you sort of, that's replicated like at least 30 times in the book. But the fascinating thing, I think, is that no one feels aggrieved.
No, not at all.
Because
they're thrilled to have met him.
Thrilled to have met him, worked with him, known him. Loved him. Almost no one feels aggrieved. Not everybody, but you know, it's fascinating
way of homing in on people and then having a very intense relationship for a short time and then dropping them like a hot brick.
Yeah, like a hot brick.
Like Bob Harris is. I didn't really know that Bob Harris.
Bob introduced really the Ziggy Stardust tour.
That's
didn't
right.
He? Which is most extraordinary. Yeah.
He was dropped. Like the same way that John Peel was dropped by Mark Boland.
By Mark Boland, precisely. Exactly the same. Suddenly their usefulness had evaporated and he'd moved on.
But whereas Mark Boland made loads of enemies, David Bowie didn't really make any.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, he didn't really make enemies. And when I was drawing up a list of who I needed to speak to for the book, I mean, I wasn't... You want drama, and it's not a hagiography by any stretch of the imagination, but I wasn't looking for people who had difficult relationships with him. But... you'd be hard pressed to find people who had real issues. I mean, there's some people. I mean, Elton's not a great fan of but I mean, comes. That's the other thing is that I think often if you work on a book or you're researching someone for a long time, even for an article, long article, that often you can end up after the process and you like that person a little less than you did beforehand. It certainly happened to me. I did a book on Jim Morrison once, and you sort of, at the end of it, you go, and...
Dude, I wouldn't read this. That's right.
But with Bowie, and I started... I mean, I've been a fan all my life, and I actually liked him after this process more than I had done when I started, because I think he was a fundamentally decent person.
But I think you understand also that he's so driven to be that successful... You have to be incredibly self-interested and driven. And there's a bit very early on where he's a teenager, about 14 or 15, and he sends a cassette of his music to Paul McCartney. And then he rings up a potential manager, a prospective manager, and says, "Brian Epstein's got the Beatles, you need us." You know, it's that kind of incredible confidence that he's got.
That was a combination of a few things, because he was brought up in Brixton during a period when a lot of Brixton... you remember the old entertainer Winifred Atwell?
Oh yeah,
and she bought
a row of houses, and
she bought a lot of property in Brixton for investment purposes. And a lot of people in the light entertainment industry lived in Brixton. Dickie Henderson, John Major's father, the circus entertainer, etc., etc., etc. And his father was obviously, as most people know, a PR for Barnardo's. So he came into contact with a lot of sort of B and C list celebrities anyway. So he grew up thinking that having an ambition to be an entertainer was no different to having an ambition to be a lawyer or a doctor. So I'm going to be a singer, I'm going to be an entertainer, big deal.
Before we move on, I just want to ask you a further question about Mary, is it Finnegan? Sorry. Not about her in particular, but just generally speaking, I always feel rather sorry for normal people who are swept up in stars' lives. That they're kind of only of interest to anybody because of what they can tell you about the star, you know. How do you find a person like that deals with it?
Well, there's a sort of group of people. There are the people who have the one story, who have the one anecdote, they're usually the 300-word people.
Yeah.
There are the people who over-embellish their relationships. And there are some people who are so-called Bowie experts and who always put their hand up when there's a media opportunity, who perhaps didn't or weren't as liked by Bowie as... I'm not going to mention any names, but there are a few of those. But as I said earlier, I think most people are just pleased to be in the orbit, to have the sort of halo effect of knowing David Bowie for a brief period of time.
Right.
Or indeed a long period of time.
Okay. So I wanted to talk about the two of the key women in his life and his family background, which you alluded to a little bit there. You know, his father was a PR for Barnardo's.
Yeah.
But his mother, he had a very difficult relationship with... this is on his wedding day, where his mother shows up uninvited, is that right?
She gate crashed. Yeah, he had it. He had
That's not a
it's
normal.
Not a good
family.
Sign, is it? It's not a good sign when your mother gate
crashes. Your mother gate crashes your wedding. Life is.
Why was there so much friction? Because he adored his dad, didn't he?
He had a very close relationship with his father. His mother was quite cold. I think I spoke to lots of people who knew her, and she was a very cold person by all accounts. Yeah, he had a... in fact, there was one story, again, a story that most people know, is when she called up the NME in the mid-70s.
Oh, yeah.
And Charles Shamari picked up the phone, and it was, hello, NME, or whatever he would say, you know.
He wouldn't say that.
Crime desk, you know. Yeah. And it was David Bowie's mother, and she wanted someone to interview her because she was seriously pissed off that he never spoke to her and then he spoke to Nick Logan and said, what do you think? And Nick said, well, go around and interview her. And then ended up with a half page piece in the NME about the fact that David's mother...
But that's a strange way to send messages to your son, isn't it?
It worked.
You could just ring him up.
It worked.
It really worked.
They
got a reaction.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
Now, the other figure in the family is his brother, Terry.
Yeah.
So what's, you know, having talked to loads of people who are involved around this, what's your...
There are sort of swirls of misinformation and fake news, largely based on the Gilman book of 1986 called Alias, where he interviews one of the aunts who basically conjures up this background of madness and schizophrenia. I mean, His half-brother was schizophrenic and eventually killed himself and had a very troubled life, and they had a much closer relationship, I discovered, than I thought. But the rest of the family had issues and, you know, bad things happened to them, but they weren't mad. And the additional problem is that, like the way that he slightly amplified his bisexuality, I think he slightly amplified the bit crazy nature of the bad genes in his family around the time of Man Who Fell to Earth.
But it made interesting art, didn't it? I
mean, well, he always used to say, "Print the myth."
Yeah,
yeah.
Print the myth, because it's more interesting.
Do you think Angie Bowie, just a point, and this is because to quite a lot of people in the book, actually, do you think she doesn't get the credit for what she did for him?
Absolutely.
I mean, she was really important in advising him to...
Fundamental. Not just in creating Ziggy, or at least compiling the elements, but also teaching him that he could keep doing that by taking a bit of this and a bit of that and building up this a new jigsaw every time. But I wrote a book about Bowie about 5 or 6 years ago, about the Top of the Pops performance, and a micro book about what that meant to the 70s, blah 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 blah. And I wanted to speak to Angie, and she wanted money. And it wasn't a very big advance. I didn't need Angie for the book, so I didn't interview her. But for this book, I absolutely needed Angie. So I paid her. She's the only person in the book I paid.
She's the only person you paid.
Yeah. But she was brilliant. Very generous with her time and anecdotes. She wasn't... You know, she's been interviewed many times, but she wasn't using this as a way to get back at him. You know, she's made some difficult and some odd career choices, but she was tremendous. And I think she does get very bad press, actually, very bad press, because, as you say, she was core. to the creation and success of Ziggy Stardust.
So she was the person who encouraged him to be adventurous at a point when he wasn't quite clear.
Yeah,
about
have this haircut, these boots, that dress, these
that
sequins,
dress.
The dress, all of this.
Yeah,
stuff.
She
I mean, she bought the dress.
Yeah.
She said, "You all look good in this dress."
And she encouraged him to go to talk about his bisexuality, didn't he?
Yeah.
Didn't she?
And again, that was, I think, something that was slightly amplified.
Yeah, so talk about that a bit. So, you know, this whole...
This is
he got an enormous amount of press,
This isn't the cover. But it was in The Melody Maker, and it was by Michael Watts, as most of us know, and that was the interview in which he claims that he is bisexual. But regardless of how true it was, and I think it was a little bit true, you talk to so many people from that generation and who felt... Because he didn't just inspire people to create pop groups and be artists and what have you. He encouraged people to actually be slightly more honest or less guilty about their sexuality. That's very powerful, particularly in the 70s, particularly with teenagers. And I know lots of people of my generation who, it's a cliche to say, but they think, well, David Bowie says he's gay, and then maybe it's okay for me to say that I'm gay.
It was also
that's powerful. That's really powerful. Bob Dylan didn't do that.
He was the first pop star who talked about anything like that. I don't remember anybody ever talking about him. Beatles never talked about anything intimate like that at all.
No, I mean, it was a generational thing, and he was being slightly expedient, but it was incredibly uplifting and refreshing and enlightening, and for some people it was like having a door opened, I suppose.
But you think it might have been exaggerated,
bisexuality?
What does that mean?
Well, I think he was a little bit...
Well, he had an affair with Lindsay Kemp, doesn't he?
How are you a little bit bisexual?
Yeah, well, he has relationships.
I want to know. Yeah.
He has relationships with Lindsay Kemp, with Lionel Bart. There's a passage in the book about the three in a bed with Mick Jagger. I don't know what they did in bed, but they were in bed.
Counted his money.
But
well, there's a bit with Simon Napier Bell. Napier Bell, who managed the Yardbirds and Mark Bowen, he's offered the chance to manage Bowie, and it's part of the package is you get to sleep with the artist.
He was,
I mean, absolutely astonishing.
But well, he was very confident in his sexuality. He was very well endowed, and obviously his expediency his expediency manifested itself in his ability to perhaps sleep with people for ulterior motives.
Do you know, we've done loads of these podcasts and we've never talked about anybody's dick.
No, we haven't. No,
I feel
we're going to make this a regular question from
there
now.
It's the Jim Care.
I mean, the book isn't tawdry, but there is a...
it is in bits.
I speak to people who were involved in Labyrinth, and there's someone describing how they had to film because he's with these sort of stupid little puppets. And of course, everything is done at waist height. And of course, all you can see is this massive cock. Massive cock, little puppet. Weird.
Oh, that's bad.
Weird.
That's the title.
Good title for a book, actually.
It's very good.
Title of the podcast.
Just
massive
what do you ask
cock,
one?
Little puppet.
Yeah, just one quick thing about that is control of the press. He's incredibly good at manipulating the press, wasn't he? He developed these kind of, particular friends and particular titles, and would then ring them up and see how they were and to develop friendships. Tony Parsons, he would ring up and talk about the problems of being a single dad.
But it worked. You've interviewed many more pop stars than I have, and you want content, you want material.
Yeah.
I remember years ago, when I worked at the Sunday Times, I went to interview Gwyneth Paltrow because she was filming, she was making Shakespeare in Love at Pinewood or Shepperton or somewhere. Simple enough endeavour, just go down there, interview her, get an interview, come back, she's on the cover of the Sunday Times magazine, not complicated. Anyway, she had no interest in talking to me. I mean, what a cow. Literally. She sat like this, monosyllabic, and after 25 minutes I'm ushered out and I've literally got nothing. So... I didn't set out with doing this kind of piece, but I basically went around the entire set asking anyone and everyone the same question: what's she like? And everybody went, eh. Yeah.
Is she a cow?
Yes.
That's right.
No, I didn't say that. I was not leading the witness. But it's not difficult to charm people. Bowie was brilliant because he knew that you wanted to walk away feeling like, you know, like you've been to see a cowboy film, and you walk out and you're sort of, you want to have a great meeting. And even though you knew you were sort of being manipulated, you didn't mind because it was so entertaining. And he would look at you and think, I know what you're like, Markel, and you like this, so I'm going to talk about the things that you like and ask you lots of
questions. He would have talked about the incredible string band to you.
He would have done.
Yeah, he would have done research. Yeah, he did.
He'd have got you straight away.
Absolutely.
That's all right. Okay, so this is you touched upon this, your earlier book. You know, this is the key moment
when we talk
about 1972.
I mean,
there are five people who talk about this, and Tracy Emin and Neil Tennant and
Gary Kemp, Nick Rhodes.
They're all in the book talking about this particular moment. What was your recollection of it?
Well, that for me, that frame, that's the one that's the one that people reference at the end of the book when I interview people who knew him very well about what it was, you know, where they were when they heard he was dead and the thing. That's the important point about David Bowie, that image, because we, you know, at that time, Top of the Pops watched by 12.5 million people, 25% of the population. Huge, like Steptoe and Sino. It's like porridge. It's like everybody saw it. But all of us thought, he's talking to me. Yeah. That's the connection. That's the thing that you didn't have with the Beatles or the Stones, or maybe you had it with Bob Dylan. I don't know. That's not really my thing. But he's talking to me. He's not talking to you. He's not talking to anyone here. He's talking to me. And we all feel that, and that's incredibly important. But if you go to the next one, which is... That's my parents... taken when they were very glamorous and they just got married and they were both...
She was smoking heavily.
She was, she was a nurse. He was in the RAF. But the last significant time, or the last time I saw my father before he died, and he had a conversation he asked me what I was up to. And I told him I was writing this book about a performance on Top of the Pops, and he gave me a funny look, and I described the music and the emotion and the fantastic colours and the great costumes and the kaleidoscopic nature of this whole thing, and he let me bang on for ages and ages, and then he said, you do realise you had a black and white television, don't you? It's a true story. And so a lot of that is sort of received.
Just, exactly. You
pile it on.
Exactly.
Well, TV was only just going from black and white to colour, wasn't it, at that point?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Lots of things were still in black and white, regardless of which telly you had. I wanted to talk about this picture, not just because it's on the cover of my best-selling book, Dylan.
That's outrageous.
Outrageous plug there.
Really outrageous.
This is David Bowie arriving backstage at Hammersmith in 1973 to play what was the last Ziggy Stardust show. And it's extraordinary because he's already behaving on a kind of massive scale, isn't he? He's behaving as if he's an absolute superstar.
Whereas
he wasn't really, was he?
No, but a lot of this was down to Tony DeFries, his manager at the time. Basically saying you act like a star, and the one brilliant thing I think it's a, you know, piece of minutiae, but him telling David Bowie, never open a door, do not touch a door handle, let someone else do that.
And just, someone said, you are this someone. Moment he never has to. Doors are all open for him.
Let someone open the door for you. You, Markel, are a star. Never touch a doorknob. I thought that was brilliant. And you act like a star, and you're he was acting like a bigger star than he was, because he wasn't really, but he assumed the mantle of a legend.
Because he'd been touring America, and then he came back. He did Earl's Court, and it wasn't a huge success, was it? Because he'd overestimated his pulling power.
Yeah, I spoke to a lot of people who went to that concert, and it was by all accounts
it was
a disaster. Yeah. It was hubris. Yeah.
This picture, an interesting thing about it, he's on his way to play the last Ziggy Stardust concert. And I think in that afternoon he'd rung the NME, is that right, and told them that he was going to
He rang Charlie Murray.
And they printed this before he'd actually made the announcement on stage.
Yeah, he rang Charlie Murray at the NME and said, I'm going to knock it on the head.
Yeah.
Charlie tells a very, it's in, you know, in the vernacular, and he said, yeah. And he knew when the NME went to press. And it went to press on a Tuesday.
Yes.
Because
this is the analogue world, isn't it?
I was fantastic. As a Rube, living in the home counties. You got it on a Thursday. And I remember one of the most amazing things, when I moved to London in 1977, finding out you get the NME on a Wednesday afternoon.
Wednesday lunchtime, yeah. Oxford Circus.
Completely changed my life.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
He used to find loads of rock stars down at Oxford Circus waiting for it to arrive.
But he knew when it was published, so he said that, I'm not going to knock it on the head tonight. Last gig, haven't told the band, but here's the story. And so the NME presses were printing before he announced on the stage that this was the final Ziggy Stardust concert. I mean, that's cold.
It is cold. It is cold.
It's extraordinary. So we talked a little bit about Bob Rummel. And you've got there's a story in the book about, these are obviously a load of us on stage aware, but I think you've got a story in there from, is it the art director of Arena? I was very interested
in
this.
Robin Derrick, yeah.
Go on, tell us what happens.
Oh, this was when, I don't know whether it was he was shooting the clothes for Arena or the Sunday or for Vogue. I think it was when he was doing for Vogue, where he went after Arena. And the conceit was that Kate Moss was going to wear lots of Bowie costumes. And so Robin went over to the archives, which were then in Switzerland, got all this stuff. Coco was there choosing things, brought it back to London. Kate Moss comes into studio, tries on clothes, takes pictures, bish, bash, bosh. That's the idea, right? Good idea. But she couldn't get into them. You know, Kate Moss, that thin. David Bowie, thinner.
Well,
they had to ring up David Bowie and ask permission to let out the clothes in order for Kate Moss to. I mean, he must have had a 26, 25 inch waist.
He weighed 95 pounds. Various people mention that in the book, which is unbelievably little, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's extraordinary.
Skinny and small.
And at one stage was living on kind of just one raw egg a day and 40 jetain. And a big pile of cocaine.
That's a good diet.
Yeah, very good diet. Yeah.
Switzerland. There's Hanif Qureshi told me a nice story about Switzerland, because when Bowie, which was where all the archives were stored for a while, Bowie moved to Switzerland at the end of the 70s to escape tax and drug dealers. And he lived in a variety of houses, but I think the first one was just outside Geneva. He knew nobody. He literally didn't know anyone at all. And I think he's there for a couple of weeks, and then 5:30, there's a knock on the back door, the kitchen door, and it was Roger Moore.
Hello, like, David.
It's like Stella Street.
Who's going to do Roger Moore?
He did.
Hello, David.
Roger Moore comes in, has a cup of tea, stays for a drink, tells lots of really entertaining stories about the James Bond films. He stays for dinner. They have a fantastic time. Brilliant. Next day, 5:30. Hello, David.
Hello, David.
It's Roger Moore again. Roger Moore comes in, has a drink, tells the same stories, which are slightly less interesting the second time around. Yeah. And so he said that after about 2 weeks, every day at 5:25, David Bowie could be found underneath the kitchen table with all the lights off, pretending not to be in bed. Just in case Roger Moore came around. I love that story.
That's brilliant.
Rick Wakeman lived there too, on the same mountain in Montreux.
But Robin makes the point that, I know these are obviously, you know, very extreme examples, the ones on this picture here, but all Bowie's old clothes, they were clearly stage costumes, weren't they? They had tape in the back of them, and you know, they were like theatrical. They were wardrobe, weren't they? They weren't clothes. They weren't normal clothes.
Well, that's what I go back to what I was saying earlier. It was costume. But they were all kept.
Yeah.
And they were all kept because he kept everything. I mean, that was...
Had he kept everything way back?
Well, that's the thing. One of the most extraordinary things about the David Bowie is... exhibition, one of the greatest exhibitions there's ever going to be.
There's one in the V&A.
Yeah. He'd kept everything because a lot of that stuff came from his archives. In fact, the only thing they didn't bring over from New York was the white saxophone because it was too fragile, and he didn't want that to happen. So the one they use in the show is a fake of some description. But there's nothing about David Jones. It's all about David Bowie. There's nothing pre-David Bowie. Right. It's all about...
There's no personal mementos.
Nothing.
They're professional.
It's all business. Strictly. All strictly business.
Yeah. Interesting. So,
This is interesting, because somebody in the book makes the point, I think it's Nick Kent, that, he realised that the 60s was over, the Beatles had broken up, no one was listening to the records by the band anymore, and he wanted to deliberately attach himself to people who were moving forward and going into the future. And one of those was Iggy Pop, and the other one was Lou Reed. Would that be right, do you think? Was it as simple as that?
And
as scientific as that? These are the people I need to learn from. Because he talks about copying Iggy Pop. So what did he copy from him?
His name.
Yeah, true.
Stage mannerisms, stage diving, yeah. Walking on hands. And they had there are lots of themes in the book of him looking for sort of old, big brother people and little brother people. People he wanted to sort of co-opt and people he sort of looked up to. And I think Iggy represented both, actually. That's Tony DeFreeze in the background.
Yes,
there.
I want to talk about...
But when they lived in... I can't remember who it is, but when they lived in Berlin together... Someone describes a bit like the young ones. It's like David Bowie coming in for, who's had my cheese?
That's great.
It's like Iggy Pop stole my cheese.
Who's going to wash up?
And Iggy
up?
Pop will come like, who's had my sausages? You've had my fucking sausages. I love that. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant image.
There's something competitive about the way they spur each other on to more and more outrageous behaviour. In fact, there's another bit where you talk about when he goes on holiday with John Lennon. To Hong Kong.
Yeah, I mean,
and
that
they drink snake's blood.
The thing that surprised me about that is I always thought that apart from brief sojourns in Los Angeles, that John Lennon never left Manhattan. But apparently he used to go on holiday all the time, and he talks about he'd basically have a suitcase with a T-shirt in it and a passport and a load of cash, and he'd just go off places. And then when he needed a new T-shirt, he'd give the T-shirt to a very grateful fan, John Lennon's T-shirt, buy a new one, and then carry on. But, they did. He was, I think, even though John Lennon was a very different writer and a sort of very didactic, I think that he was the only, one of the few people that Bowie genuinely looked up to. Obviously easy to look up to a Beatle, but he kind of knew everybody, but he had enormous affection for John Lennon. Mm. Enormous affection.
Tell us about Tony DeFreeze.
Well, Tony DeFreeze, who I've got an hour of interview with Tony DeFreeze. I don't quote because it was off the record, but I talk about it. It took me ages to get to Tony DeFreeze, who obviously is a legendary figure who doesn't give interviews and doesn't talk about David Bowie. I found him bizarrely through LinkedIn, which is something I'm sort of...
It's useful for something.
Finding Tony DeFreeze. That's finding ex-managers of David Bowie. LinkedIn is something I don't often use, but I don't know why. I think I was clearing up some or looking for the... they have these request things, and it suddenly occurred to me, why not? And I punched it in, and after playing sort of LinkedIn and then email tag for a while...
So, sorry, did Tony DeFreeze get a thing saying, Dylan Jones would like to connect with you on LinkedIn? That's hilarious.
Yeah. That's how it works. And then we ended up having this email correspondence, and then I spoke to him. I've still got the tape, and he was incredibly proud. Again, not bitter... and still was convinced that he had done the right thing, that he was a good guy, not a bad guy, etc., etc., etc. He was fascinating to. I think he lives in Johannesburg. But at the end, he got very excited. Said, "Well, I could do something in the magazine, and I could help you co-promote it, and I could." And I thought, "Hold on, and he was trying to getting more and more involved. And I thought, well, I'm going to get the interview. And then he said his final email was this. He was going to do all of this stuff, but it was going to cost me £360,000.
There you go. There you go.
To which I responded immediately, you either have a very keen sense of humour or a completely unrealistic idea of the publishing industry. And that was it.
But his involvement with David Bowie, he kind of bankrolled, you know, Hunky Dory and so forth, didn't he? Because he didn't have a record deal at that point, you know. So he got on board with him when nobody really believed in him.
Oh, he was as important as Angie was in the creation of Ziggy Stardust and propelling him to stardom. Absolutely.
But in return, he took kind of Colonel Tom Parker.
He took all his money. it's the legend. It's the typical story of rube rock, fledgling rock star signing a contract not looking at it. Yeah. And
at one point has 150 people on the payrolls.
Oh,
right?
God, yeah.
So he was just milking the money out of
what
Bowie was earning.
So how long did that last for? How long was he paying Tony DeFries for?
Till 1982, which is when he made Let's Dance. When he started doing Let's Dance.
You think
Dance.
He was holding back
Of course he was.
Until the deal was
Yeah, because every, you know, a percentage of everything he earned up until then was going to Tony DeFries.
Right.
So it was only after that was finished that he decided to make this incredibly commercial record.
So what are the two albums before Let's Dance, I'm trying to think?
Scary Monsters
Scary
and Lodgers.
Monsters. Oh, well, that did well. Yeah, it did well, actually.
Oh, right. Well, there you go. Yeah. So participated in that. So you mentioned that you talked to two kind of early friends of David Bowie, one George Underwood.
And this is Jeff McCormack.
This is Jeff McCormack here. Tell us about Jeff McCormack.
They were in the Cub Scouts together, weren't they? Is that right?
Yeah, I think he knew Jeff maybe. I can't remember which came first, George or Jeff. But, yeah, from a very, very young age. And that's War and Peace. He was the backing singer basically, Bowie wanted a mate to come on his great adventures. So he sang on the Diamond Dogs tour, the Young Americans tour, travelled all over the world with him. And the weird thing about Jeff, who's a lovely man, practically same age as Bowie, sounds identical to him and looks like him. Not facially, but same body, same build. It's quite unnerving, actually. In fact, the other person who really sounds like David Bowie is Alan Edwards, his long-term PR. In fact, Alan, when they were in Australia on tour for the Let's Dance, Alan often used to do radio interviews as David Bowie.
Brilliant.
True fact.
That's great.
True fact.
We were talking about Let's Dance earlier. Well, you mentioned it just now that he unleashed this at the end of his deal with Tony DeFries. That was a kind of huge hit out of nowhere, wasn't it? I mean, that was also his last hit. Am I right in saying?
No, it wasn't his last hit, but it was. He had lots of hits after that. Blue Jean. And stuff like that, Loving the Alien. I mean, lots of hits in the 80s.
But Let's Dance was a huge hit.
It was a massive hit. And it was started as a folk song. It was, he showed Nile Rodgers a photograph of Little Richard getting in or out of a red Corvette or a Cadillac. Make it sound like that. But yeah, it was him attempting to and successfully making a very, very, very popular record. And I don't know if you remember this, but lots of people, possibly even myself for a bit, would go, because he'd done something too commercial. Sort of grumbling, because even though he was an incredibly famous pop star, still at the early 80s, he was sort of like, he was my David Bowie. He's not
but isn't that
David
just a
Bowie.
Classic thing of being a fan? You don't want to share him with more people. You know?
Of course.
You want people to be sort of gloriously unsuccessful, bravely, courageously
but
doomed.
That was a huge hit. You know, he did the kind of the saucy video for China Girl, didn't he, and so forth.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was, you know, de rigueur in those days to get on MTV and so forth. And did he regret Let's Dance?
He regretted it almost immediately. There's something that Bono tells me in the book, that they're in Australia and they're in a bar drinking beer, playing pool, And David Bowie's really, really upset. Because this would have been, oh, I don't know, maybe 84, I think they're touring, 84. And he's basically crying into his beer, thinking, I've ruined my life, I've ruined my credibility.
I've sold 11,000 albums, I've made an absolute hash of it.
It's like, yeah, and they're just on the cusp of success. Yeah. And they're thinking, what?
Yeah.
You're David Bowie, and B, you've just had the biggest success of your career. But he was genuinely conflicted. He'd achieved something very special, very particular, and yet he was already questioning the sort of status of what he'd just done.
So was he aware of his own brand, and he felt it was possible to be too popular if you were David Bowie?
Yeah, and actually, from that moment onwards, the insecurity sets in, and each successive reinvention is very self-conscious. And I think you can look, everything up until Let's Dance it has a logic to it. Everything after Let's Dance has an element of insecurity about it, yeah. Regardless of which direction he's going in. I'm going to be a member of the world's worst rock group.
Yeah.
I'm going to try drum and bass. I'm going to wear a Union Jack jacket. All of this stuff. I mean, and some monstrously fantastic records as well as some awful ones, but that's where the insecurity sets in.
Okay. Let's talk about his films.
Did you go to see... you went to see Prince's Purple Rain with Mick Jagger at one point. And I think Julian Temple, and both Jagger and Bowie were
both
immensely envious.
Both furious that he'd managed to
produce a great film.
Yeah, so competitive. But actually, Prince, Purple Rain, one film. The Eminem film, 8 Mile, was it called?
Yeah.
Madonna, Desperately Seeking Susan, David Bowie, Man Who Fell to Earth, all films which sort of exaggerate to a certain extent. A version of their own personality. Bowie, not a great actor. In fact, Jeremy Thomas, who produced Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, says in the book that everything that he does in the book is according to his ability. How long he can talk for without, how much can he remember? What does he do with his face? He's very stoic in the film, which fits the character, but he couldn't act very well. But the thing is, he turned up, for him it was like going on holiday. He'd turn up and say, well, I'm not micromanaging this one. What do you want me to do? Literally, what would you like me to do? You're in charge, I'm the vehicle, dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee. This is from A Hunger, the terrible vampire movie.
Which is where
movie.
You met him, was it?
Yeah, I was an extra on this film. And it was my scene, I think it was 1981 or 1982, I just left St. Martin's, and my scene, I was a film extra. I also shoot down Roger Moore's plane in Octopussy.
Yeah.
You're welcome. And it was my job to walk up and down the metal stairs in Heaven, the gay nightclub underneath the arches in Charing Cross, brushing past Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie as Bela Lugosi's Dead by Bauhaus blasts out of this. And that, for me, at the tender age of 21, was still a fact. I mean, I thought I was going to live off this anecdote forever. And then that afternoon, in another part of the nightclub, where there were pool tables, he actually asked me for a light for his Marlboro. And for me, that was like, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Yeah.
Literally.
Job done.
And then 3 years later, I'm a journalist. In fact, it was very... I interviewed him 7 times altogether, and it was very important for me that the only quotes, apart from 2 that in the book from him, are from interviews that I did. Not because... I think they're particularly revealing, but I knew the veracity of them. I knew what they meant, and it's also quite difficult going back through old interviews and sort of taking things which work in context with the right tense that makes sense. But there were some very, surprising sort of themes that came out of those, mainly themes of insecurity, actually.
Right. So, moving on.
Well, Rick Wakeman did...
The great Rick Wakeman.
He says he's done 2,000 sessions, but of all the sessions he'd done, it was Bowie was the person he learnt the most from. So what would he have learnt from him?
And he played the piano on Life on Mars.
And Hunky Dory, I think, was it?
The thing about Bowie is, I think lots of people think, oh, he got away with it. He was a great showman, he wore the funny clothes, he had the funny hair, charming, thin, good-looking, but he somehow got away with it. But actually, I interviewed lots of musicians, and they're just full of respect for him. I mean, he wasn't a virtuoso, but he was a tremendous singer, always one take, hated doing two takes, a bit like Frank Sinatra.
Really, literally one take.
Yeah. Backing vocals, knew where to pitch everything, knew how to join things up, great arranger, a proper musician. And he doesn't really get the cred for that. I think that lots of people think, oh, he sucked the blood out of this one, he sucked the blood out of that one. I mean, I tend to think of him like a great football manager. It's like, you know, you pick the right team for your project.
So you get the right performance out of people.
Yeah.
But he did very much rely on a series of key musicians that he worked with.
Well, he's smart.
Mick Ronson, obviously.
Carlos Alomar, Al Rogers, Mick Ronson, as you say. I mean... But that's smart, right?
Yeah.
You know, you're not going to pick dodos.
No. Sure. We've included this picture to stand for. This is obviously a picture from the movie Almost Famous. To stand for David Bowie's considerable sexual appetite.
It's incredible. I mean, you have to expect someone who's as experimental in their artistic sphere. As he was, would be experimental in their sex life. But the sheer creativity and diversity that is absolutely astonishing. And you tracked down quite a few of some groupies and some old girlfriends.
Yeah, I mean, there was... never forget that for a couple of years in the early 70s, David Bowie was a fully-fledged rock star with the appetite of a rock star, and suddenly this big candy shop, this big sweet shop, and he ate everything. But this refers to a woman called Josette Caruso, who she goes to see his gig. I think it's at Carnegie Hall. Anyway, New York. There's an after party. There's always an after party. They have a connection. He says, you can't do anything here because Angie's here, but come to Philadelphia. So she goes to Philadelphia. She doesn't go to the gig this time because she's seen the gig. She goes straight to the hotel. She's in the hotel suite. And she describes this seduction of Bowie coming back from the concert, them drinking very good red wine, there's candles. It's all very...
They talk about art and films and,
it's all very lovely.
It is.
And then there's a knock at the door. Another knock at the door.
Hello,
it's not Roger Moore.
David.
And it's Stewie George, who is his long-term bodyguard. And he says, David, I think you need to come and see this one. And Bowie goes out, and then about 5 minutes later, he comes back, even whiter than he was when he left, because he was the white face and the red hair and the jump suit. Really shaken. And he sits down and she says, what's the matter? And what had just happened was someone had just come to the hotel suite with a recently deceased cadaver for him to have sex with. Now, this is odd, but...
I hope it's odd.
Think back to 1973.
Oh, yeah.
Every rock star in North America...
Different times.
..looked like a member of the Eagles. Yeah. Double denim, long hair, cowboy boots, T-shirt, studded belt. Everybody looked like a member of Led Zeppelin or the Eagles, Deep Purple. Everybody looked exactly the same. And for people had never seen anything like... We take it for granted now. There's 1,000 images of David Bowie every day on Instagram. But he had orange hair. He had white face. He looked like a freak. He made these bizarre records. And people thought to themselves, what does he like to eat? What does he like to drink? How does he like to have sex? And so obviously some deranged fool thought that he might actually want to have sex with a dead body. And he didn't.
Well, there is an enormous amount of evidence of his sex life in the book, which is highly entertaining, I have to say, and mind-boggling.
This is a picture of David Bowie making young Americans
Station to Station.
Sorry. Okay. Is this Harry Maslin?
Harry Maslin, who produced Station to Station, as far as I was aware, never been interviewed before. Not for 40 years, anyway. And I interviewed him in a Masonic lodge in Santa Monica. Very nice man. Very nice man. And he described the recording process of Station to Station. And when Bowie would eventually come into the studio, and I'm no expert, but with sort of a really good pharmaceutical cocaine in some sort of cylinder, and he would walk around the recording studio, and he'd put a little pile on the mixing desk, he put a little pile on the guitar amp, he put a little pile in the vocal booth, he put piles of cocaine all over the studio. And Harry said, "Why are you doing this?" He says, "So I don't have to walk." So he could be in any part of the he was so addicted to cocaine at the time, he needed it all the time, like 24 hours a day, that he had all these piles of cocaine all over the recording studio. I've never heard that before. Maybe you have. You're veterans.
New to me. But also, I mean, at one point he stays up for four consecutive days. You know, you just can't believe he manages to record anything at all.
Well, this is his period of I'm going to be a really good drug addict. And
contribute to the heart attack? It must have done.
Actually, I think the heart attacks, plural, were caused by smoking. I mean, he was a ferocious smoker. He smoked forever.
Never stopped, is that right? Did he stop?
No, he stopped. Yeah, right, stopped after he had the attacks. But, he smoked. I mean, I don't think it helps if you take cocaine every 5 minutes for 3 years, but...
Nine out of ten doctors recommend it.
This is another thing about recording Station to Station in Cherokee Studios. He would come in and record Station to Station, which, along with Young Americans, possibly his best record ever. And at the time, quite a deranged, old-sounding record, unlike Young Americans, but the sort of fusion of East and West. He would go in, record Station to Station, and then later on that day, Frank Sinatra would come in because he was recording a Christmas album. And they used to go to dinner together. And this was complete news to me. But I spoke to...
Bo did a backing vocal on one of the
tracks, didn't he? Yeah, he's on, yeah. I don't know which one it is, but there's one or two songs on the Christmas album that he released at the end of 1977, where David Bowie's... And they would go off to Dan Tanner's or a local Italian restaurant. I mean, what a picture. How extraordinary. Yeah. Can you imagine David Bowie in his state and Frank Sinatra, him drinking whiskey and him with his pharmaceutical cocaine, sort of pushing carbonara around. I mean, it's just amazing.
How did the paparazzi miss that one?
I know, exactly.
Yeah. God's sake, that's the Penny Black of paparazzi pictures, isn't it?
It is, it is.
That's absolutely extraordinary. Yeah. You talk about Alexander McQueen, who you
This is in reference to Earthling, where he wears the Alexander McQueen Union Jack jacket, a Union jacket, which at the time I think maybe is not, you know, it's a favourite of many people here. I thought it was a masterpiece at the time, and now I think it's pretty shoddy. But this is to demonstrate Bowie's ego, because and we were talking about this earlier on, and I flew over to New York to have the worst experience, which is listening to the record that the artist has just made with the artist, just you and the artist. And we discussed what an awful thing. And they always play it really loudly, so it sounds amazing. Anyway, so he plays...
Tap your toe furiously and look.
He plays Earthling, and it's obviously front-loaded, so all the good songs are at the front. So he plays the first one, and it's amazing, brilliant. You know, second one, fantastic. Third one, yeah, pretty. And then he's sort of running out of superlatives, running out of adjectives. And me, I mean, I was in my mid-30s at the time. I should have known better, but I acted like such a fool. I actually thought in my conceited way that he actually really genuinely wanted my opinion. Yeah. So after track five or six, I'm going, well, it's all right. But it's not. The other one, brilliant. Yeah. But this one, and of course, he was not interested. He just wanted me to say everything was a piece of genius. And that was, he was quite frosty after that, actually.
Right, yeah. Right. So do you think he knew that it wasn't that good?
That's a really good question. I think when you're when you're famous like that and you are used to people just never saying no, I think you get into a state where you're probably more confident about what you're doing than people who don't have that support system. I think he was... I think in hindsight, he was a pretty good judge. But, I mean, he made some... I mean, the thing is, you have to remember that there were long periods of time in the 80s and the 90s when it was fantastically unfashionable to be A, David Bowie, or B, like David Bowie. Peter York was funny about this. In the 90s, when Bowie co-ops the YBAs and he's friends with Tracy and Damien Hirst and lots of people, he would often turn up... Peter York, he'd say, he'd get calls from an artist saying, David Bowie's in my studio and I can't get rid of him. Because you didn't want his patronage, because there were periods when it wasn't cool to have anything to do with David Bowie.
It's true, you forget that because of the obituaries, you know, and all that was written around the time of his death. It's as if it was just
fantastic
one
through line. Everything's
incredible,
a brilliant
plateau of success.
Yeah,
the through not line true is a myth, isn't it?
Of course it is. I mean, literally. I mean, Tin Machine. I mean, even people in Tin Machine hated Tin Machine. Three.
Three, live one.
Oy Vey.
Oh, God.
Oy Vey, babe. Or something.
Yeah,
anyway,
like that.
Awful. In fact, I remember, I think I was at Arena at the time, sending Tony Parsons to interview Tin Machine in Dublin. And Bowie made this big thing as I'm in a band, okay? I'm in a band. Everyone's as important as each other. And Tony,
you had to interview the drummer. And
Tony did this brilliant thing. He basically turned up, and he thought, right, and he interviewed everyone else. He interviewed the, you know, Mickey Mouse 1, Mickey Mouse 2, Mickey Mouse 3, and he's interviewing all these people. And Bowie's like fury, wants to get in on the action. And so finally, when he's saying, "What do you think, David?" He's like, the floodgates are opening. It's quote after quote after quote after quote.
Yeah.
Shocking records. Awful things.
I've got a picture here of the great David Hemmings,
who directed a film I haven't seen called Just a Gigolo, which I think is meant to be one of the worst films ever made. The only reason that David Bowie made this film was to meet Marlene Dietrich. And the only reason Marlene Dietrich made this film was to shoot David Bowie. They are in scenes together, but they're filmed separately in different cities. And by all accounts, it's a real stinker. But the point about this is that after this... for some reason, maybe before they'd seen the final edit of the film, Bowie hires Hemmings to do a tour film of the Isola 2 tour, which I think is 78, I can't remember, which apparently was so bad that he bought it immediately, and it remains in an archive and has never been seen by anybody. But my point is that this was a very extravagant, I think this was the black and white tour, very long, very austere. There was an interval. It was very sort of in your face. I mean, very cutting edge, difficult. It's where Throbbing Gristle got all their ideas from. It was quite an intimidating show. And at the interval, what he used to do is he used to come in, and apparently he used to stand like this. He used to stand like this and watch a television, and on the television there were pre-recorded video cassettes of Coronation Street. And this is how he sort of...
It's his homesickness, isn't it?
I don't think he was... I think this is his way of sort of kind of like calming down for 20 minutes, still dressed in all the in the gear, before going back out again. I think that's absolutely amazing.
It's extraordinary.
Isn't you?
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
Certainly is. So I think...
Oh, this is an extraordinary period, which, again, in all the obituaries and everything that was written about him when he died, you know, I thought it was fascinating that the one bit we didn't know anything about was the mysterious time in New York, when he disappeared into New York and became, as you were saying earlier, like John Lennon. You know, he was almost invisible. And occasionally you'd see a picture of him by the paparazzi, often holding a Greek newspaper, which is a brilliant idea, wasn't it? So the people David Bowie? No, it can't be.
He said the easiest way not to be recognised in New York is to walk around in a cap carrying a Greek newspaper, and it kind of worked for him. But he was...
What did he do? So how did he occupy his time?
He did normal things. I mean, I spoke to... I had a little bit to do with him during that time, but he wasn't engaged. He didn't want to talk to people in the industry, people in the press. He'd occasionally have dinner with kind of friends who were in the industry. But he did what John Lennon did. He stayed at home. He went to Dean and DeLuca. He brought up his daughter. He was a house husband. He poodled around and I think was very, very happy. I think that the domestic bliss that a man afforded him was incredibly satisfying. And
were you surprised that he managed to produce two records without anybody knowing in the outside world that was going on?
I mean, I think everybody was. I think the next day, I think when he came back with Where Are We Now, it was done in such secrecy with just so much style and elegance. And it was good. I mean, talent is finite. We know that. But I think that if you have the amount of talent that David Bowie have, and you probably don't stop writing songs for 10 years, even though you're not recording and you're not on tour. And so it's possibly not a great surprise that when he goes in to make a record, that there are some tremendous songs on it. And that's a great record. But the last record, Black Star, I think it's too pat to say that this is his sort of requiem. This was the tail end. It was all orchestrated. I'm going to die when their record's coming out. I mean, that's awful. But it's the record was actually finished quite a few months before he died, and the only reason it was held up was because of the videos. And when they were making the videos, I mean, he knew he was going to die. And that whole, I think Jimmy King suggested it, sort of, why don't you get back into the wardrobe? It'll be funny. And they're in fits of laughter because they think it's got a funny thing to do. But he knew he was dying at the time. But it wasn't as orchestrated as everyone likes to paint, because it's a very sort of pat end to an extraordinary career to stage manage your own death. But I don't think that's necessarily
true.
Do you
think the exhibition at the V&A was very important to him?
I interviewed both the curators, Jeff and Vicky, and I mean, yes, it was. They describe it as a bit like when they first went to New York. They were given these. All the catalogues with all the archive stuff in. I mean, what was in the exhibition was a 20th of what they have. And if they wanted to request something, it was a bit like it probably was used to be in the British Library, or maybe in foils, where you had to pay for something, then fill out a chit, and a very convoluted process. They actually had to handwrite what they wanted, and then it would be given to someone, and then... And they quite quickly realised that Bowie was in the next room.
Yeah,
it was like he said, it was like the Wizard of Oz,
right?
You know, micromanaging everything to the nth degree, and to the extent that the stuff that was used in the exhibition was basically. I mean, he supplied. He didn't micromanage it, but he basically supplied what they had, and he came to see it. And one of them. I think Vicky, this was the only time she'd met him, and Jeff was off on holiday, and says that it would have been, he personally would have been, it would have been too awful to meet him in case it wasn't everything that he wanted it to be. But he saw it and just said to her, he said afterwards, just said, thank you. And that was it.
Thank you, Dylan Jones.
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.